This morning's text comes from Psalm 27. I'm calling this reading, God in the Midst of the Darkest of Moments. And as Andy prayed, we can consider the dark moments the people of other places are now experiencing. But we can also consider the dark moments we might be currently experiencing, or those in our close circle might be currently experiencing. 2 weeks ago, my family and I were on a two-week pop-up camper vacation / adventure. And when we take that pop-up trailer, it never ceases to be an adventure. In the first few days of our trip, we had the opportunity to, in Idaho, visit with one of Rachel's cousins, Curtis. He was recently diagnosed with a rather aggressive form of cancer, and the trip had been planned months before the diagnosis, but we happened to be traveling right through where they live. And so there was a moment that we seized upon, and we spent several hours in his home with him and his wife, Michelle, and their three children, Taylor, Megan, and Caden. Curtis passed away this weekend. And one thing have I asked the Lord, that will I seek after, is going to be verse 4. That I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord, and to inquire in his temple. God in the midst of the darkest of moments. Psalm 27. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? When evildoers assail me to eat up my flesh, my adversaries and foes, it is they who stumble and fall. Though an army encamp against me, my heart shall not fear. Though war arise against me, yet I will be confident. One thing have I asked of the Lord, that will I seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. For he will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will lift me high upon a rock. And now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me, and I will offer in his tent sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody to the Lord. Hear, O Lord, when I cry aloud, be gracious to me and answer me. You have said, seek my face. My heart says to you, your face, Lord, do I seek. Hide not your face from me. Turn not your servant away in anger. O you who have been my help, cast me not off, forsake me not. O God of my salvation, for my father and my mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me in. Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me on a level path because of my enemies. Give me not up to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have risen against me, and they breathe out violence. I believe that I shall look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord.
Good morning, everyone. Last week, if you were here, we studied Psalm 73 and we talked about faith. And we started with the fact that faith is universal. that everyone has faith, whether they consider themselves religious or not, whether you consider yourself religious or not, you are a person of faith. What marks a Christian is not that a Christian has faith. What marks a Christian is that a Christian has faith in Jesus. Faith is a given. Everybody lives by faith. Everybody looks at our lifetime and relies on someone or something to make life worth living. So you can rely on Jesus. You can rely on the sense that you're making a difference in the world. You can rely on really good food. But it's all faith. And we also talked about the fact that faith is personal. That it isn't a reality that you can hold out there. If your faith is in really good food, that will affect not just breakfast, lunch, and dinner time, but the pattern of your thoughts and emotions throughout the day. And this psalm, Psalm 27, is an expression of faith for people who are overtly religious. For Christians in particular, faith is best and most frequently expressed in prayer. We show and practice our faith in Jesus by praying, by talking to him, and that's what David is doing here. Before we get into it, the context is likely the time of Absalom's rebellion, which you can read about in 2 Samuel chapters 15 to 19. What you really need to know is that it is bad. David was king until his own son Absalom staged a coup, a rebellion against him, and David had to flee from his home, from the capital, and is now in hiding in the woods, expecting any moment to be confronted by his little boy and have he and his friends killed. And in those circumstances, David writes this prayer. And those, I realize that nobody here is on the run from their child who is seeking their life, at least I assume. But the circumstances can be broadened to the dark moments that may be with you and in front of you right now, or maybe in your past, or maybe coming for you in the near future. How do we pray? How do we express faith when things aren't easy? And there's essentially two threads in this prayer, in this psalm, and they're woven very tightly together. So as we look at them, we're going to be kind of ping-ponging all over the psalm to get and pull on these threads and understand them rightly. But essentially, David's prayer breaks down to two things: preaching and pleading. In this psalm, in this prayer, David preaches and he pleads. And prayer is those two things. Prayer is preaching and prayer is pleading. So that's how we're going to look at the psalm this morning. So prayer is preaching. You may or may not be aware that you are a preacher. That it's not just myself and Andy who have that task, but that every believer, and I mean every person of faith in anything, is a preacher. We remind ourselves of what we have faith in. We tell ourselves what we believe to be the truth over and over and over again. What distinguishes me from you is that I do it with a larger audience. But the activity is essentially the same, and that's what David is doing right now. He's not preaching in the sense that I'm preaching right now in front of a bunch of people. He is preaching to himself. And as he prays, he is preaching to himself who God is, and he is preaching to himself to have faith in God. David preaches who God is when he prays, and he preaches to have faith in God when he prays. So David, he preaches who God is. He starts off very boldly right at the beginning, preaching who God is. The Lord is my light and my salvation. Whom shall I fear? The Lord is the stronghold of my life. Of whom shall I be afraid? There are worlds here, just here in verse 1, and we're just going to touch lightly on them. To say that the Lord is light and salvation is to imply that apart from him, we walk in darkness and need rescuing. To say that the Lord is the stronghold of life is to imply that apart from him, we are not safe. That we are not okay, we don't got this, and that God is the one who can rescue us. God is the one who can shed light on our lives. God is the one who provides safety and refuge. In the middle of the Lord of the Rings, things are not going well for the good guys. They are at a little town called Edoras, but they are totally outnumbered and outflanked. They don't have an army, and a bad guy army is coming for them. And so they run to a place called Helm's Deep, which is this fortress tucked away in the mountains that has this long history of protecting these people from their enemies. And there they wait and hide out. Even there, they're not really equipped to fight against their enemies. They're just trying to hold on until Gandalf and the good guy army rolls in and saves the day. And in that moment, right, Gandalf is not just their salvation, he's their light. He arrives right at the dawn, and the sun comes up over the hills, and all is made well. God is Gandalf and Helm's Deep in that story. God is the stronghold that protects us in the darkest of moments. God is the light that illuminates what he's really doing. God is our salvation. He is our rescue. And you hear how personal this is. We're not saying God is light in the cosmic sense, or God is salvation in the cosmic sense, although that is true. I mean, the whole story of the Bible from the first page to the last is the story of God breathing light into darkness. But that's not what David's talking about here. He's saying the Lord is my light and my salvation. If you read this little psalm, these 14 verses, you will find 52 iterations of I, me, or my. And the next most common thing you will find is the Lord, which appears 12 times. And the Lord, as it probably reads in the Bible you're looking at, is actually God's personal name. It's not referring to God as an entity. It is the equivalent of marching into the Oval Office and addressing the president as Donnie. That's what David is doing. He's saying not just you light up things, you save. He's saying you save me. You are my only stronghold. That is who you are. And I realize even at this fairly early point, you may not be following along with this. You may find the idea that God is light and salvation alarmist. You might say, my life is okay. I don't feel the need to be saved. I think I'm doing all right. It's pretty arrogant of you to imply that I need saving. You might find it, on the other hand, you might find it kind of quietist for me to imply that all that you need is God. That whatever your situation is, what you really need is God. That Curtis's family, what they really need in this moment is God and not their dad back. Is just kind of silly and absurd. And I understand both of those complaints. Let me try and paint it for you like this. Apart from God, your life may not be, but can be, like a beautiful bouquet of flowers set on the dining room table. Apparently vibrant and full of good things. But with no larger permanent source of life to draw on, what's going to happen to those flowers? They are going to wither and die. No matter how beautiful they might be in that moment, no matter how good they might seem in that moment, apart from God, there will be no light there. On the other hand, life with God may be very much like, it doesn't have to be, but it may be very much like a few flower seeds that have been dropped in the ground and covered up. And there appears to be absolutely no life there. Absolutely no light, absolutely no hope. But with God, those seeds will be carefully tended, nurtured and watered, and in time, something that isn't just beautiful for a moment, but has lasting and life-giving beauty will grow. The Lord is my light and my salvation. The Lord is the stronghold of my life. What we're saying is, I need God, and God is all that I need. I need God. I cannot do without him, and God is all that I need. All the other things that seem essential actually aren't. They might be good, they might be important, but they're not necessary. This is what David is preaching to himself. He's reminding himself of who God is. And not just that God is who I need and that God is all I need, but that God is with me. That God has given himself to me. This is what he's saying in verse 5 when he says, For God will hide me in his shelter in the day of trouble. He will conceal me under the cover of his tent. He will lift me high upon a rock. All of those metaphors, the shelter, the tent, the rock, they all imply the same two things. One, safety. And two, God's presence. The tent, the shelter, is not just any tent. He's not talking about my six-person Coleman that I have in the garage for camping trips. He's talking about the tabernacle, the place where God dwelt. The place where you could find God's presence, where you could be near to him. So he's not talking about God building you your own fortress off in the mountains to protect you from what's going on in your life. He's talking about God drawing you to himself and being your refuge. That God will take you in himself. That he will bring you near and keep you safe. It's like this. After our first daughter was born, Vanessa stayed home to take care of the baby, and I kept my wonderful job as a carpenter's helper, making $11.82 an hour. I remember that vividly, because for the first 8 months of Haley's life, we were in the red. Every month, we were coming up several hundred dollars short. And we knew that was coming, and we'd been saving up for the preceding 9 months, but we were watching our not-all-that-grandiose savings account dwindle and dwindle and dwindle. But the whole time, we know that if we can't manage to make ends meet, if I can't find extra work, or we can't juggle something where Vanessa goes to work in the evenings, or we can't figure it out, if all else fails, we could always move back in with my mom. She'd been very clear about it. She wasn't even like offering it as a last resort. She's like, if you wanted to bring my granddaughter and come live with me, that'd be okay. All right. We had a refuge should we need it, and that's what God is for you. Now, it might be the case that your relationship with your mom is such that even if that offer were on the table and the alternative were being homeless, you would be like, sign me up for the streets. Or it might be that you have as wonderful of a mother as I do, and it's still true that after a few months or a few years, you would all be quite sick of one another and ready to move on. And that's exactly why David says in verse 10, my father and my mother have forsaken me, but the Lord will take me in. Even the limits of fatherly and motherly love, as they are meant to be, don't apply to God's love for you. Even the boundaries of care that the best human parents have for their children don't apply to God's care for you. He will take you in, no matter what, and forever. You don't have to be a good son or a good daughter with a track record of doing the chores and contributing. You don't have to be good at staying out of the way and not stepping on his toes. God will take you in. This is the truth. And this is what David is preaching to himself. God, I need you, and you are all that I need, and you have given yourself to me, and you will never take back what you have given. No matter what, you will take me in. And David is reminding himself of this in the darkest of moments, because it is so easy to forget. He is telling himself the truth because the truth is hard to believe, because the light is hard to see, because the lie creeps in. The false story that God is not what you need, that you do got this, that the retirement fund is full, and that life seems fulfilling and your health is good, and so you're going to be okay on your own. Or that things are not okay and you need someone or something else more than God. That lie is constantly grabbing hold of us, and so David preaches to himself. He tells himself the truth. When you pray, do you tell yourself the truth? God, I need you, and only you. And in Jesus, I have you. Help me to remember that. Help me to hold on to the truth. When you pray, do you preach the truth of who God is? David did, and then David didn't stop there. He knew that this was personal, that this prayer was personal, that his faith was personal, and that who God is was meant to affect who he was. That knowing God was meant to shape him. And so David also preached to himself to have faith in God, to put his trust in God. And when he preaches to himself about faith, he's doing it as the antidote to fear. David is experiencing fear and is trying to remind himself to have faith. What do you fear? What makes you afraid? Or, if that's not an easy question to answer, turn it around. What's your as long as? As long as I have this, I'm okay. Or, you know, maybe as long as I can eventually get this, I'll be okay. Is it health? A happy family? A good retirement? A nice place to live? A sense that you're making a difference? Whatever it is, that's what you fear. You fear losing that. And David knows this. He's experienced this. He's in the throes of losing that which he was most afraid to lose, the affection of his son. We'll come back to that later on. And he's reminding himself that he does not need to be afraid. So those questions in verse 1, whom shall I fear? Of whom shall I be afraid? That's not David being macho. Those aren't rhetorical. He knows the answer, and he's trying to remind himself, I don't have to be afraid. I don't have to fear. Things are as bad gets. And it seems that all I feel is fear. But I don't have to. That's why he ends. Wait for the Lord, be strong, and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord. This is David talking to God. He's not preaching to the masses. This is David saying, David, wait on the Lord. Be strong. Come on, God. Take courage. Wait on God. It's going to be okay. God is with you. Faith is the antidote to fear, because faith in Jesus, belief in the truth of who God is, that he's all you need and that he has given himself to you, means that whatever else it is that you might lose or that you have lost or you are in the process of losing, God will still take you in. God has still got you. That's what he's saying in verse 13. I believe, I have faith that I shall look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Now look, we hear that with good Christian ears. We hear the land of the living and we think, oh, heaven. But that's specifically not what David is talking about. He is specifically talking about this lifetime, this side of the grave. He's saying, I have faith that whatever else I cannot see, whatever else I lose, I will be able to see God's goodness. So how is it that we see God's goodness in the land of the living? It's one thing to believe that someday, one glad morning when this life is over, I'll fly away. But that's not what David's talking about. He's talking about this week. God reveals his goodness to us in the land of the living through the use of signs. If you've read the Gospel of John, Jesus comes and does signs to reveal God's goodness. And those signs might be present in nature. You might look at a mountain, and that mountain could be not just what it is itself, but a sign of God's eternity, that he is everlasting and he is not perturbed by the things that pass through. Or you might walk outside and see all the trees and be reminded that God takes tiny, insignificant things like acorns and grows mighty and beautiful oaks. And see there a sign that God could take someone as tiny and insignificant as you and grow someone mighty and beautiful. and you might see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. Or you might see signs in history, and this could mean a grand scale cosmic history. One of the main themes of the Old Testament is God's people reminding themselves of the signs that God did in the Exodus. He brought these plagues, he split the sea, he led us through the waters, he provided bread, he provided water. It can be that kind of a sign in history. It can be very personal. On one of the darkest moments of my life, when it was hardest for me to see God's goodness, one of my kids had been hurt badly, and I remember thinking, as a father, if I had had the power to prevent this, I absolutely would have. You call yourself father. What are you doing? I stayed up most of that night, and then in the morning, had an email from my friend Sam. And it just said, I have no idea why, but I woke up at 2 this morning, and I could not go back to sleep without praying for you for an hour. Hope all is well. Sam. That is a sign from God. Hey, I'm not telling you everything that's going on here, but I see you. I am still taking you in. I've got your back. We get to see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. But this isn't a sort of simple one-off process. David writes in verse 8, you have said, God, you have said, seek my face. My heart says to you, your face, Lord, do I seek. That verb, do I seek, is in what's called the imperfect, which means it has no end. It does not mean, I sought your face, I saw it, and now I'm good. But that I have been seeking your face, I am seeking your face, I will always be seeking your face. Faith is a seeking. Faith is not, you heard the truth about who God is one time, and you prayed one prayer, and you got a little faith card, and you put it in your back pocket, and now you're good to go. Faith is again and again and again. It is a constant seeking to look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. So, if this has happened to you recently, you have recently seen the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living, rejoice and be grateful, but don't imagine that you're done. There are more signs to see. And that sign of God's goodness was not just for you. I'm so glad that Sam didn't just keep to himself, that God had woken him up and asked him to pray for me. Or, if you're someone who hasn't seen a sign of God's goodness in a long time, or if by a long time you mean ever, take heart that the search is not over. Wait for the Lord. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Wait for the Lord and know that where you are is exactly where David was. When he says, I believe that I will look upon the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living, he's saying that because he can't right now. When he looks around, he sees no goodness. Know that you are not alone. That faith is a seeking. David knows this, and David knows what it looks like when faith plays itself out. He knows what it looks like to practice faith, to put this preaching into action. That's verse 6. And now my head shall be lifted up above my enemies all around me, and I will offer in his tent, in God's tent, sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody to the Lord. I will offer sacrifices with shouts of joy. I will sing and make melody to the Lord. These are the practices of faith. Well, I'm going to do them in reverse order. So I'll sing and make melody to the Lord. You guys, you acknowledge that it's weird that we sing. That normally if people other than a professional group of musicians are going to sing with lots of other people in the room, there's got to be a lot of a certain lubrication to bring that about. And we show up on Sunday mornings and do it because it matters that we sing. Singing shapes us. It takes that truth of who God is and how we are meant to live and plants it deep in us, slips it past our doubts and our cynicisms and our logical defenses and puts it where it belongs, at the very center. I mean, this is true of all singing, right? If you've seen Star Wars, I can go on and on and on about how cool Star Wars is, Or I can just hum the Imperial March, right? Dun, 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 and we're off. Singing does that in a way that me expositing Luke Skywalker never will. The same is true of the real, capital T, actual truth of who God is. That singing of him shapes us, re-centers us, reminds us that singing is, in some ways, the very best form of preaching. Singing is a practice of faith, and sacrifices with shouts of joy are a practice of faith. You know what a sacrifice is. I mean, in David's case, it was a pretty bloody affair, but it's giving up something good. But David's not just talking about sacrifices. He's talking about sacrifices with shouts of joy. Anyone can make a sacrifice for any number of reasons. Next month is Asante month, when we renew our commitment to provide tuition for kids who can't afford to go to school at Lighthouse School in Kampala. And many of us will make a sacrifice. But many of us will do that in the sort of cold logic of the $225 that it costs for one of these kids to go to school means so much more to them than it does to me, right? I spend $225 every time I go to Target for a pair of socks. Leave with 18 things I never knew I couldn't live without. But for them, it could be a lifeline. And so I do the calculation, and I write the check, and I'm done. I made a sacrifice. But to make that sacrifice with joy, to be not just willing to do it and maybe a little bit embarrassed that I can so easily afford to do it, but to rejoice at the opportunity to do it requires me to have faith that that sacrifice is not just going to bless Priscilla or Shalom in Kampala, but me. That in giving up some small part of myself in accordance with God's will, I draw near to him and so get what I need most by giving up something I need much less. And the sacrifice becomes not just an obligation, but an opportunity to rejoice. That's living faith. Living as if I need God and God is all that I need. And God has made himself available to me. These are the practices of faith, and David is preaching these practices to himself because he needs them to practice, because it doesn't come naturally, to get better at faith, to grow into it in an ongoing, seeking way. These things really work. You guys know that one of the forms the lie takes for me is that I start to believe I need a neat house as much or more than I need God. Which, when I say it out loud, is pretty stupid, right? But that lie can get its teeth into me and turn me into a grumbling, self-pitying, self-righteous cesspool in no time flat. And you know what works best in response to that? Is consistently singing. Getting out my little phone and opening up Amazon Music and turning on the Gettys or the Gray Havens or Andrew Peterson or whomever and singing the truth. Because it finds its way through. It gets past my airtight logic of how important and simple a clean house is. It gets right to the heart of me and preaches the truth. Praying is preaching. Preach to yourself day in and day out who God is and what a life of faith in God looks like. And when we do that, when our prayers begin with preaching, then we will be ready to do what we usually think of prayer as, which is asking for stuff, right? When we have preached well, we will be able to ask well. We will be able to, as James says, ask rightly. When we have reminded ourselves of the truth, then we're able to plead in accordance with that truth, not in accordance with our truth, whatever that is. As praying is preaching, praying is also pleading. And David, in this psalm, does plenty of pleading. Here in Psalm 27, we see David pleading for God and pleading for God's deliverance. David pleads for God, and he pleads for God's deliverance. So David pleads for God kind of throughout the psalm, but I want to focus in on verses 4 and 9. 4 is the one Tim highlighted. One thing I have asked of the Lord, that I will seek after, that I may dwell in the house of the Lord all the days of my life, to gaze upon the beauty of the Lord and to inquire in his temple. And verse 9 is the flip side of the coin. Hide not your face from me. Turn not your servant away in anger, O you who have been my help. Cast me not off, forsake me not, O God of my salvation. On the one hand, let me be near you, and on the other hand, don't hide from me. And I want you to notice what David isn't asking for. Remember, David is on the run in hiding, trying to escape his son who has rebelled against him and wants him dead. And David, nowhere in the song, asks for God to defeat Absalom. He doesn't even ask for reconciliation with Absalom. And it's not that those things would have been bad to ask for. It's just that David knew what he needed most. And so he asked for that first. There's nothing wrong with asking for God to defeat evil. There's certainly nothing wrong with asking God to reconcile you with a family member. But those things, as good as they are not what you need most. Having preached the truth to himself that God is all he needs, David has the wisdom to plead for what he needs, to ask for God himself, just let me be near you. Notice also that David is asking for things he said he already has. Right? The Lord is already his light and his salvation. The Lord is already going to draw him into his tent and hide him in his shelter and lift him up on a rock. And David is still asking, you're going to take me into your tent. Can I please go into your tent? You're going to reveal yourself to me. Will you please not hide your face? David recognizes that, well, the absolute truth is that God is near and that God will take him in. He has lost the ability to see that. So David is not praying for the light of God to shine. He knows that God's light is already shining. He's praying, rather, for God to open his eyes and let him see. When you pray, do you have the honesty to admit, I know you're there. I can't see you. Help me see. I got glasses in the sixth grade. A little over 20 years ago. And I have two vivid memories associated with getting glasses. The first is this. I put them on and walked outside and looked at a tree. And discovered anew that you could see leaves on a tree. I had genuinely forgotten. I had no idea. I did not know that I was blind in that way. The other memory I have is the day that I finally realized I needed glasses. I was sitting in the third row in Mrs. Weiner's sixth grade English class. And she called on me to read something from the board. And I tried to read it, but it was just this kind of faint blue smudge. I had no idea what was up there. And it was really one of my prouder moments. I broke down in tears and started sobbing in the middle of an English class. It's every 11-year-old boy's dream. You see what happened? First, I didn't know that I could not see. Then, all of a sudden, I knew, but I didn't want to know. I did not want it to be true. I just wanted to be like everybody else in the class. And then finally, in admitting that I could not see, now I can. And notice also that it wasn't a one-off thing, right? Having done that, I cannot now leave these at home. I have to put them back on every single morning. And for some reason, they're always falling off the little nightstand, and I have to sort of scrabble around in the semi-darkness trying to locate them. But having admitted that I cannot see, I can be made to see. Having admitted, God, even though you are right there, even though you've been present the whole time, I am so blind that I cannot see you. Will you please open my eyes? God will let you see. Wherever you fall in that, if you are unaware of being blind, or if you kind of are aware but would rather not be, have the honesty to plead for God, for God to make himself known. Hide not your face from me. One thing have I asked of you, that I may dwell in your house and gaze upon your beauty. Plead for what you need. Plead for God. You plead for God and plead for his deliverance. Right, this is verses 11 and 12. Teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me on a level path because of my enemies. Give me not up to the will of my adversaries, for false witnesses have arisen against me, and they breathe out violence. I am surrounded, I am besieged, I am under attack. Help me out. Get me out of this. Andy already pointed out that this is kind of difficult language for us to empathize with sometimes. And so certainly the first thing to do with these verses is exactly what we already did. Recognize that God's people are always under attack somewhere. It's been a long time since it was Oregon. But we as a people are always under attack, and pray for those who are on the front lines. Pray for Andrew Brunson. On another level, while not facing any kind of political or physical persecution, some of us read this and go, yeah, I know who my enemy is. I work with her. I live with him. We face it in our day-to-day lives, someone who has set their face against us. And so here we see how to pray in light of that, not against our enemies, but teach me your way, O Lord, and lead me on a level path because of my enemies. For false witnesses have risen against me, and they breathe out violence. In the face of enemies, in the face of people who would have you not believe the truth, but would have you believe that you need their approval more than God, ask God to teach you his way and lead you on a level path, to let the truth be stronger in your heart than the lie that you hear from someone else. So some Christians, some brothers and sisters face physical enemies. Many of us face more intimate personal enemies. All of us face enemies within. All of us face enemies that live in our own hearts and minds. This is even true in a sense for David. He made Absalom his enemy. I don't know if you know this, but if you read the whole story arc, David's great fear is that any of his kids will ever dislike him even for a second. And he is a horrible father. His kids get away with, I am not exaggerating, rape and murder without consequence or even admonishment from him, because he just doesn't want them to be mad at him. And Absalom learns the lesson that I can do whatever I want, that I should do whatever I want, because all Dad wants is for me to be happy. David made his enemy. As much as Absalom is absolutely another person, he is the fruit of David's heart and mind, as well as of David's body. Our enemies live within us, and they grow stronger as we nourish them. In the same way that Absalom grew stronger on David's bad parenting. Our enemies are the lies that we are most prone to believe. And this, every sin that you can imagine, is at its root this kind of enemy. A lie that you need something else more than you need God. You can do what I'm about to do with every sin you can imagine, but we'll just do sexual temptation and religious pride, trying to pick from opposite ends of the spectrum here. If you are beset with sexual temptation, with anybody, which anybody who has knows that if you feed that guy, he gets stronger, not weaker. But if you are beset with sexual temptation, what's at the root, what's underneath it, what keeps you coming back is the lie that it's giving you something you need. The physical pleasure, the connection, the sense of being significant enough to be wanted by someone else. That's what's at the heart of what's going on. Not a picture you saw or somebody that was walking down the street, or a coworker you're particularly tempted by. It's the lie that you need what sex has to offer more than you need God. On the opposite end of the spectrum, take religious pride, this sense of I do the right things, and therefore I'm okay, or therefore I'm better than you. Right? What's at the heart of that? What's at the root of that is the sense that what I really need is to believe that I'm a good person. Or if not a good person, at least better than those obviously bad people. Y'all know that religious pride doesn't have to be a church thing. Your religious pride can be, I'm so much better than those lemmings that have to sit in the pews. I connect with God all on my own. But that lie, that what you need is to believe that somehow God owes you something because of how good you are, it's the same basic lie that pornography is telling. Here's something you need more than God. These are the enemies that get us. And the Bible tells us that what makes these enemies dangerous is how familiar and innocent they seem. One of the first times that sin comes up in the Bible is when Cain murders his brother. And what God says to him about it is he says, sin is crouching at the door. Sin is crouching at the door and its desire is for you. And the image there is of Cain walking into his living room and sin hiding behind his front door in the place where he's most comfortable, where he's most familiar. And that word crouching is a big cat about to strike. Scrunched down in the grass so that you can't see it and you won't notice it. That's what the lie is doing in you. And it's not going to be satisfied until it's got all of you. Its desire is not for a few minutes of your time or a few dollars out of your bank account, but for your whole self. And so when you plead to God to deliver you, you are saying, I've preached the truth to myself. I've told myself that you're all I need, but in my day-to-day life, I still struggle to believe that. Help the truth to set me free. To break the power that these lies have over me, release me from them. Teach me your way and set me on a level path. Don't let the false witnesses lead me astray. When you plead in your prayers, that is what essentially we are to plead for. That God, the truth, would rescue us from the lie, that the light would bring us out of the darkness. And we have the privilege of knowing that he will. That God has given himself to us. Not only has he lifted us high upon a rock, but he was lifted high on the cross on our behalf. In Jesus, we know, not just hope, not just guess, we know that God will take us in. Jesus is God's ultimate light and salvation. Jesus is the final stronghold. He's the revelation of what God is really like. He came as a sacrifice and lived sacrificially that you and I might sing, that you and I might pray, that we might draw near to God because Jesus voluntarily drew near to us. And so in him, we find the truth. That Jesus is our light and our salvation. That Jesus is the stronghold of our life, and so we do not have to be afraid anymore. Because there's nothing that we can do to change it. There's not a single thing you can do in 2018 that can change the fact that Jesus died, that Jesus is risen, that Jesus will come again to take you in. So brothers and sisters, wait for Jesus. Be strong and let your heart take courage. Wait for Jesus.